You're listening to The Cutting Edge, presented by Hilleberg the Tentmaker.
Hi, I'm Petra Hilleberg, president and CEO of Hilleberg the Tentmaker. My dad, Bo Hilleberg, a lifelong outdoorsman, founded Hilleberg 50 years ago, and we've been family-owned, family-operated, and European-made ever since. We proudly specialize in building strong, lightweight tents and in never compromising on quality of materials or construction. Our tents have been specifically chosen by polar expeditions, mountaineers, backpackers, and avid outdoor adventurers just like you all over the world. We build tents for everyone's adventure.
We get additional support from Blue Ice, makers of lightweight, robust gear for serious climbers and skiers, developed and tested in Chamonix and in Utah's Wasatch Range. And from Bivouac Coffee, a craft roastery making naturally processed and sustainably roasted coffees in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. This is Dougal MacDonald, editor of the American Alpine Journal and host of this show. For our final episode of the 2023 season, we're heading to Kishtwar in northern India, an area of very dramatic granite peaks, most of which have only been climbed by one or two routes. One of them is White Sapphire, a peak of 6,040 meters, or just under 20,000 feet, that had only been climbed twice. Pete Takeda, the interviewer for this episode, had shared photos of an unclimbed big wall on White Sapphire with a young friend named Christian Black. In time, Christian recruited his friends Hayden Wyatt and Vitaly Musienko as partners, and in October, they all headed to India. A major storm in the first week of the expedition put the kibosh on any big wall plans, but the trio quickly identified another line. In fact, this whole story is one of flexibility and improvisation. Two of the three climbers had never been to the Himalaya, and the interview captures their wide-eyed enthusiasm, as well as the ability to go with the flow, a critical element for success in the greater ranges. And success they had, with a challenging new route up White Sapphire from the north, Brilliant Blue. Pete spoke with Christian, Hayden, and Vitaly the day after Christmas. Enjoy the show.
We're recording the Cutting Edge podcast, and I'm at the Waco Rock Ranch in El Paso, Texas. Can you guys, let's start with Christian and go to Hayden and Vitaly. Can you guys introduce yourselves?
I'm Christian Black. I'm hanging out in Salt Lake City right now, where I just moved. What other info do we want from us?
That's about it.
Yeah. I'm Hayden Wyatt. I'm currently in Portland, Oregon. I just got back from a family trip to Bozeman for the holidays and do some ice climbing with family.
My name is Vitaly. I'm 37 years old. I'm a registered nurse, and I am currently in Bozeman as well, but live in Salt Lake City.
Great. Well, congratulations to you guys on your first ascent. And I've read Christian's write-up that's going to appear in the American Alpine Journal. So sounds like a tremendous trip. Maybe we could start with you, Christian, and work our way around and just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in this. And if anyone wants to jump in, yeah, feel free to do so.
Well, let's see. It's a very vague background. I found myself wintering in Spain and doing some sport climbing, where I happened to meet you, Pete. Or I met you in Mexico the previous winter, actually. And as I recall it, we were just hanging out on the porch, and you were like, hey, I got a cool idea that you might be interested in. And I was like, oh, all right. I like ideas. And so you kind of just told me a little bit about this random wall. I didn't even know if you've actually been there or not, but I was like, yeah, we'll give a shot. And so kind of just wrote up the grant and threw it as a Hail Mary, and I didn't really think much of it, but just kind of one of those like go for it and see what happens or what doesn't happen type thing. So
yeah, and then the team won the Cutting Edge grant. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we got the Cutting Edge grant from the American Alpine Club. They gave us about $8,000 to put towards this trip. which is great because I don't think the trip would have happened without it. I've never been on like an expedition of this scale before. And so given the fact that it's expensive and like logistically foreign to me, I don't think I would have ever gone without the help of the American Alpine Club. So it was definitely the catalyst that gave us the push we needed to get out there on the other side of the world and try climbing something. So we're very appreciative of that.
Yeah. And Hayden, when were you pulled into this? Was this during the grant process or did Christian spring this on you at the last second?
Yeah, so I was actually finishing my first semester of law school in December when I remember Christian just sending me a photo of the White Sapphire and saying, hey, my friend Pete said we should go check this out and we should apply for the Cutting Edge grant. So I submitted and I threw your name on it. And I kind of just threw it away and was like, well, I'm in the middle of finals. Like, I'm not going to worry about this right now, but sounds cool. Like, we're never going to win the Cutting Edge grant to go do that. So whatever. And then it was in late January, I think Christian got the first call from maybe Jack Tackle or something on the Cutting Edge committee and was like, hey, you guys are in the final running. Can you send us an updated budget? And Christian and I are both, you know, we weren't in the same place, but we kind of looked at each other on and we're like, wow, okay, shit, we might actually go to India. We got to figure this out. And so it was in January/February that Christian and I really dug into what we had kind of applied for here. Thanks to you, Pete, giving the inspiration. And then before I knew it, Christian had been awarded the Cutting Edge grant and we were looking for a third person to be brought on the trip.
So Vitaly, you were kind of pulled in, was it the last minute or pretty late in the game?
Not too late in the game, no, maybe around March or so. And me and Christian get along very well, so I just knew I would have to go. I just had to find a delicate way to tell my wife.
Yeah, and Vitaly, out of the three of you, you are the only one who had prior Himalayan experience, is that correct?
Yes, correct.
What was your reaction when these guys showed you this objective?
Oh, it looked amazing. Checked every box that I could have for an expedition to get interested. A great team. I've done many climbs in the past with Christian, and I trust him completely with his choice of partners and friends, because we're not only climbing partners, we're friends as well. It checked a box that it's somewhere I've never been, a remote area that I heard about but never seen this wall before, don't know how to get there, a total adventure. Yeah, sign me in.
And so if we were to do a little chart of who knew who prior to this expedition, you were really good friends with Christian, and Hayden, you were really good friends with Christian, though Vitaly, you and Hayden didn't know each other. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, was there any anxiety or tension about that, or was that instantly dispelled when you shook hands for the first time?
I think it was dispelled, actually, when I met Hayden's parents. I met them before I met Hayden, and talking to his dad and his mother, who were both legendary guides in the Tetons, I just trusted Christian and his parents that Hayden is probably just as great of a human as they are. And I was really happy that we're going on this expedition together, and it's a chance to meet another good person.
So it must have been beneficial to have Vitaly along on this, with him being a veteran of the Himalayas. But for you, Hayden and Christian, what was it like stepping off the plane in New Delhi?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was crazy, but I think it was almost dumbed down because G20 was supposed to start the next day. And so it was just a shocking new experience to be in India for the first time for me. And also at the same time, I knew that the just culture shock of it all was going to hit so much harder in a couple of days after we left Delhi, which was pretty shut down when we initially arrived. And I think the first evening that we got there, we were jet lagged, really hadn't thought things through that much past, hey, let's get to Delhi and get it going. And the agency, basically the folks who were with Kapil, he said, hey, we got to go grocery shopping. You got to get your food. You got to pack your bags. They're getting on a truck tonight and you're going to get on a train tomorrow. So like, we need this together. And so just imagine yourself in an absolute haze, trying to assess how much food you should buy for being up on the mountain for the next 27 days. And also trying to do all your last final kind of dummy checks in a total jet lag fog at a hotel right after you just landed, and then say goodbye to all your gear and you're not going to see it until you're up in the mountains. So that was my Delhi experience.
Christian?
Yeah, I would certainly echo all of that. It was pretty challenging, motivating to do all of our chores when we were so tired. I think we basically had three flights in a row where we were just moving with the time change. So it was just daytime for like 48 hours. And so we got to Delhi after like, 28 hours of travel, and it was like 9 a.m. again. We're like, God damn it. Like, this day never ends. But for me, my like biggest emotion, like getting off the plane for the first time, was like, oh wow, like I'm actually in India all of a sudden, and we're about to like go to the Himalaya tomorrow, which is crazy because like I still feel and identify, like I still remember myself as like a brand new climber, like in college, like climbing at the gym, and then like that doesn't feel that far away, you know? And so for me, just still remembering that and then being like, but I'm about to like go to the Himalaya, like was just kind of a crazy trip for me, of like just one of the places in the world that I never thought I would get the chance to go to, let alone climb in any capacity. So that was sort of my biggest emotion I had.
Yeah. And Vitaly, had you been to India before, or is your Himalayan experience in Pakistan or Nepal? Or
it was only in Nepal, first time in India. For me, honestly, it seemed a little less chaotic than Kathmandu, which is quite surprising because I expected Delhi to be Kathmandu times 10, but it wasn't. I think maybe because we were basically packaged and sent onto the train and out into the mountains right away. It was a very quick turnaround, like Christian and Hayden stated.
Mm. Was there did you have to check in with the IMF and go through the peak fee process and all that?
As soon as we landed in Delhi, they took us straight to the IMF, straight there. We were still basically hungover from being on the plane for 30 hours, and we're walking in and getting our permit, meeting our liaison officer. And it seemed like it was all in the fog of travel.
What was your liaison officer like? Because a liaison officer can make your trip really nice, or they can make your trip a little more difficult. What was your experience in India?
He made our trip for sure. He was hilarious.
Yeah, he was a really nice guy. He was pretty young, but you could tell he was pretty excited about the mountains in a way that I think we recognized, as like people who are excited about mountains too. But yeah, he was a hilarious dude, and we were pretty psyched to get someone who was like very chill and who we could actually like get along with, and not someone who like didn't, he was at least interested, like very interested in climbing. And so he felt like he was, he like meshed with our group pretty well in that way. And that wasn't like just like a foreign person who knew nothing about climbing, trying to like implement rules. It wasn't that vibe, which was great.
On top of that, I feel like he wanted us to succeed and did everything in his power to help make that happen. Going into the Jammu Kashmir region, which is where the White Sapphire is located, you have to go through military checkpoint after military checkpoint. There are lots of police stops you have to make. And he was a huge advocate through all that process. At one point, while we were in the mountains, police from the nearest village hiked 2 days up because they said something was wrong with the permit. And we never even met him because Anand just talked him down and told him everything was in order and head on back to the police station. And he even, when we made our final successful attempt or summit in the last day, busted out the tally's camera and base camp and like took photos. So anyway, Anon was just an awesome liaison officer. And I think having talked to a number of friends, including you, Pete, about LOs in the past, it's a total make or break. They can make your life a huge pain, or they can open all the doors that ultimately allow you to go be successful out there. And that was what Anon did for us.
Oh, that's great. So I read the write-up on the American Alpine Club site. Hayden, you mentioned that this was kind of a dream that just to be traveling and trekking through the country. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like on the trek in, and what was it like to arrive in base camp and actually see your objective?
Sure. Yeah, it was a huge dream to just even be out there. As Vitaly kind of alluded to earlier, I grew up with my parents being climbers. They were Exum guides in the Tetons, avalanche forecasters in Salt Lake, and lifelong climbers. They did their own climbing expeditions to Nanga Parbat, North Face Everest,
Masherbrum,
yeah. And I grew up hearing from them, and then a bunch of the other incredible climbers that wound up being Jenny Lake climbing rangers and Exum guides in the Tetons, sitting around fires in Lupin Meadows, hearing about Himalayan expeditions. And so from a young age, it was just burned into my mind, like, oh, at some point you're going to go step it up and go to the Himalayas and have one of these wild epics. And it might not land you on top of a summit, but it's sure going to be an adventure. And I felt the whole time, regardless of whether we made the summit, this was a huge realization, because as much as it is about having a summit and a successful new route, for me, it's always been about the friendship and the opportunity to go connect in a wildly different place and to make new friends across the world. And so within just trekking in, I felt like that goal had been accomplished.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you guys get off the plane, you meet the IMF, you get on the train, you get on a taxi, you drive this dangerous, windy road, you hike in, you arrive at base camp. And what was your first impression of the objective, like seeing it there in the flesh, as it were?
Oh man, I remember we saw it for the first time on our second day of the hike in. We like rounded a bend in the valley, and then it just like poked out. Like you could see Sarah Kishwar on the left, but the White Sapphire was like still behind this ridge. And you know, we walked 100 more meters and we could see it for the first time. And I think we all just stopped and we're just like, holy shit, like we're here. This is crazy. and yeah, it was kind of surreal, because it was like before that, like we basically just had the photo that you gave us, Pete, which you know, it was like kind of blurry, kind of like zoomed in. And, you know, it's cool to see it in person for the first time. We're like, wow, that looks stellar. Like, what a piece of rock. I can't believe I'm seeing it like with my actual eyeballs all of a sudden. That's how I felt, at least.
Yeah, I remember when everyone saw it, we all got super excited because the whole face looked bone dry, and we started to talk about how many pairs of rock climbing shoes we were gonna bring up there. And I was kind of like, hold your horses, that's happened to me every time I go to a greater range where you see your objective, it looks perfect, it basically is telling you to climb me, and then it just gets annihilated with a storm. It might not look like this tomorrow. And I think in about 3-4 days after we set our base camp, it dumped snow and it no longer looked like we wanted it to look. But it was incredible to see it, because I believe it was only 4 or 5 days since we landed in India that we saw what we came there for, which was just incredible. I feel like the logistic organizers, Ind Masif, that we used, did an amazing job of getting everything done fast, such as meeting up at IMF and getting our permit, to getting us to the trailhead. It was just flawless.
Wow. So you guys were in base camp for a couple days, I assume acclimatizing, and then some storms rolled in. Is that what happened?
Well, so we, in a similar way to getting off the plane, as Vitaly describes, and getting ushered into the mountains immediately, we got to base camp, and the next day we started hiking loads up. And I believe we had gotten a load up, come back to base camp for a night or two, and then we had gone up to 14 to start acclimatizing, and we were going to bump our stuff up to establish an advanced base camp. And we got struck by a storm that was just pouring rain at 14. And we just kind of hung out in the tent for 24 hours and just weathered this rainstorm. It was a memorable experience. Vitaly was in a first light by himself and was basically in a puddle. I think he maybe even had a dromedary explode in there, so it was extra wet. And when we got out of this storm after 24 hours of not even being able to leave the tent, we looked up and the entire north face, the rock that we had planned on climbing that was bone dry and we were sure we were bringing rock shoes, was just covered in this wet snow that was literally sticking to vertical rock. So it quickly changed our goals within, I guess, 4 or 5 days of arriving at base camp.
Yeah, so in an ideal world, you would be climbing the wall. And I assume you had brought gear to do a big wall style, like free or aid ascent. Can you tell us a little bit about the original objective and how it morphed into this equally epic, arguably more epic thing? Whoever wants to jump in or take turns, however.
Yeah, I mean, I think the original objective was, yeah, certainly the rock face, because it's kind of a novel feature, like a 2,000 foot big wall at elevation. And that was, if I remember correctly, one of the reasons why you pitched it to me, Pete, was you're like, oh, well, like, you like alpinism stuff and you're a big wall climber, like, this seems like it'd be fitting for you. So that was certainly the original goal, is like, we were pretty psyched to go try to climb a big wall and do a new route. But I mean, obviously we're not dumb, and so we just brought the whole kitchen sink. So we had, yeah, everything from like big wall aid gear to like full ice climbing racks to yeah, just everything in between. And so I think we knew going in that there was a pretty good chance that, you know, something would come up and things would have to change. So we just brought it all.
Yeah. How fast was the transition in your decision from this big wall to the other objective? Did you have to recon a new route, or did you see it from your ABC, or how did that whole thing work out?
More or less, once we realized that the wall, like, there might not be a weather window big enough to climb the big wall in soon enough, it was Vitaly's idea to, or we all kind of talked about it, but I think he was the one who said it first, to look at like this like ice like mixed line on the left of it. And the original idea was like, all right, maybe we like do that as an acclimatization climb, and then maybe another really good weather window will come and we can actually try to climb the big wall, which is hilarious to think about now that, like, yeah, we're just going to like do it twice. That'll be sweet.
Yeah, yes, but in the end, you did do it twice.
Yeah.
Who wants to watch into this narrative?
Oh, man.
Vitaly, what... It was your idea to maybe try this alternative. How did you come up with that, and how did you guys approach it?
Well, I'm much more of an alpine climber than a big wall climber. Even though I've done many big walls in the past, I want to go into the Himalayas for alpine style routes. And I thought that it would be logical that if there isn't a big enough weather window, that we would need to come up with a plan B in case our original plan doesn't work out. So the line to the left looked very aesthetic. It led straight to, it seemed like a steep mixed line that led to a rock buttress. We actually were expecting the terrain to ease up when you get to the ridgeline, to the buttress itself, but it actually just dropped off on the other side, and we had to climb very steep rock pitches and, you know, crampons, basically doing dry tooling at 20,000 feet for the last 7 or 8 pitches or so.
Yeah. From the looks of the pictures and the description, it looked like it's that super fussy, slabby kind of mixed climbing. So I assume that there wasn't a ton of gear, and there are probably some spicy moments. Can you describe the climbing up there?
From the col, the first pitch looked very blank to begin with. I think I should start by saying that on our first attempt, we got to the col probably around midnight, completely cold, and we weren't sure if we were going to be able to set a BV up there. And before we got to the col, I got hit with a big piece of ice, and I had a horrible headache. And I wasn't even sure if my headache is from getting hit with an ice, dehydration, altitude. And in the morning when we all woke up and looked at the wall, I thought that it looked more like an aid climb, or potentially one where you would need to place many bolts. And I didn't think that we would be able to get up even up the first 2 pitches. And Christian, with, you know, a lot of his big wall experience in Yosemite and so on, he dove into his, well, let me just explore and look around and see if we can make it happen mode. And he started doing some creative aid climbing to start off. He took a pretty, you know, scary fall into the slab below, but he went back up and he made it work. And when we followed the first 2 pitches, we were able to actually free climb. And in the end, when after we got done with our second day of climbing, our stove ended up not working out.
Yeah, so tell us about the stove epic. I remember, I think it was like 3 a.m. and I get these messages about a stove.
This podcast is not sponsored by MSR, right?
No.
I don't know if we want to talk about it, if it is.
No, it's not. So, Christian, you should jump in here, because we got into stoves in depth. And I remember desperately searching for the user manual for the type of stove you were using. But what essentially happened up there?
Well, more or less what we thought happened was, obviously you can't fly with canister fuel, so you have to source it in whatever country you're going to. And what we thought the issue was is the canister fuel mixture they use there uses like a more impure form of like propane as part of it. So we thought maybe it was like clogging the fuel lines, because we weren't getting like any gas flow out of the stove after all. It just like dwindled down. Like I think the night before it broke, I was sitting outside of the tent like at night, like with gloves on, like trying to boil water. And it took me like about 2 hours to like boil 1 liter of water. So the stove performance was just dwindling. And then the next morning it just didn't work at all, even with like a full canister. So we thought it was the fuel mixture, but what it probably was is there's like a safety mechanism where that fuel causes the stove to run really hot and overheat, and then it like melts a little piece of lead into the fuel lines. So there's really like no way we could repair it in the field. You have to like surgically dissect the stove with tools we didn't have, and yeah, it just like wasn't going to happen up there.
After a break, we'll hear how Christian, Hayden, and Vitaly rallied for a second attempt on the White Sapphire.
Hi, this is Bill Belcourt at Blue Ice. In climbing, weight is the enemy of success. Here at Blue Ice, we make some of the lightest climbing equipment in the world to give you a fighting chance at succeeding in your objectives. The rest is up to you. Good luck out there and enjoy the podcast.
Bivouac Coffee is a craft roastery based in Colorado's Front Range foothills. They only roast natural process coffees, which have a much lower environmental impact, and this results in a low acidity, super smooth, and flavorful cup of coffee. Bivouac ships everywhere in the U.S., and they are offering podcast listeners 20% off their first order. Enter the code CUTTINGEDGE, all one word, at checkout on their website. The address is bivouac.coffee.
So you guys show up in base camp. It's perfect conditions. You have the gear. You hike the gear up. You have your line picked out. The weather comes in. You sit in the water and rain for days on end. You switch objectives. You pick this rad-looking new line. You get almost to the top. I'm assuming you're a half day from summiting, and then your stove breaks. Then what happened?
It was crushing. Yeah. So we had, as Vitaly kind of described, we had this first really huge day getting up to the ridge line that ended at midnight. This is within 8 days of reaching base camp or something. So people are feeling the altitude. We had kind of pushed to just make the weather window work. Christian has this second day on route, miraculously finds a way through these slabs that are look featureless, look like they're going to be impossible to protect without having a power drill and 50 bolts. And we got our ropes within 100 meters of the summit, so like 300 feet. And we go back to camp. And as Christian describes, you can't boil any water. It takes 2 hours. So we're pooped. We think, hey, we can go to bed. We've shared one dehydrated meal. We'll wake up in the morning. We'll boil a bunch of water. We'll get rehydrated. We'll eat a bunch of food and we'll send it to the summit. It's going to be totally fine. And we essentially woke up in the morning to the stove being broken. Pete's one of the people we messaged. We also messaged my mom and are just like sending messages being like, hey, this stove won't even light. Nothing's coming out. How can we get going? And we woke up at, I think, 5:30 or 6 to start climbing that morning. And we spent 3 hours in the tent using wire gate carabiners to undo parts of the stove, like really crafting the best we could, getting messages on ideas on how to clean it from our inReach. And essentially just it goes from stove repair to, hey, do we have the bandwidth as a team to push for the summit still being 100 meters from it? Or is it time to go back down? And essentially from the moment we woke up, we had half a liter of water to split between the three of us. Our long climbing days meant that we had eaten all of our food that wasn't dehydrated. So we basically had a handful of power bars and some candy to try to make a summit push and get back down. And just between half a liter and not very much food, we ended up having that conversation end with, hey, I think it might be pretty epic just to get all the way back to base camp on this, because we didn't have a backup stove at advanced base camp, because we had just gone so light and fast to try to hit this weather window that we hadn't brought up a ton of resources to have an advanced base camp as backup. So from that point on, we had about 2 days to get back down to base camp, where we had our first like hot drinks and were able to boil water to make food.
Yeah. By this point, how many days do you have left in your expedition? Because there's always that kind of ticking clock on these trips. Were you feeling the press of time to make a decision as to going back? Or
I think we had 16 days left. And I remember we got to our advanced base camp, no stove still, but water pooled on the glacier, little glacier lake. So we were actually able to drink water for the first time. And it was the middle of the night. And we were like, okay, we're going to sleep here and then we'll keep going down. And we definitely had conversations of like, hey, maybe we just pull everything. Like, I don't really know if we can go back up there with, even if we got another stove. We only had one other one in base camp. We had brought two on the trip, and there was conversation about just pulling it and going bouldering for the rest of the trip. But at the end of the day, 16 days was a lot of time to still make things happen. And so we quelled those urges and basically were like, hey, this isn't a good time to make decisions when you haven't eaten any meaningful meal in like 48 hours and you've spent almost 24 hours without any water. Let's just sleep. We'll get up in the morning, go light back to base camp. And then after we've eaten food for a couple of days and gotten our heads screwed back on, like, we'll still have time to figure things out if we want to make another move.
Wow. So you return to base camp, you spend some time there. What were your next steps? Did you find a new stove? Did you fix the existing stove?
Well, our logistics organizers actually were able to somehow like order a small like backup stove and like hike it all the way like 2 days to base camp. And so it showed up like maybe just a few days after we got back to base camp. So it was nice to have our backup stove. And then we had the other stove we brought was another MSR stove. It was a wind burner instead of the reactor. And that one was still working with the fuel. And we later found out it had like a different mechanism. So it theoretically shouldn't like have the ability to break the same way. So we took that one and our backup stove, and we went back up. But more or less, yeah, we got back down to base camp and rested just a few days, like 2.5 days, 3 days maybe. And then the weather looked like there would be another window coming, so we just hiked right back up to advanced base camp. Just like, I was like pretty pooped. And I was like, but you know, like, what are you going to do? You know, the clock is on. You either go or you don't go. But
yeah, and how did the round two go for you guys?
Actually, there was a round 1.5 before there was a round two. We got to the base of a route on a weather window that might be or might not be, and it didn't come. And we ended up going back to our high camp. And then Hayden hiked all the way out to our base camp to bring more food because we were running out of food. So there was, there was more to our shenanigans up in high camp.
Wow. So,
but the second attempt went a lot better.
Yeah. You know, through all this, I hear about Hayden walking back down to base camp in to support the team. You know, then I hear about your decision-making process. It seems like, you know, some teams, when they face adversity, they tend to fracture. Your team seemed to have only gotten stronger. Can you speak to this at all? It's one of those inside stories of what actually makes successful expeditions successful.
I think that's definitely the story of our expedition. Our team it really was great at raising each other up in the times of doubt when somebody was either dehydrated, tired, down somehow, mentally, physically. Everyone else always helped that person rise up. And I believe we were only just helping each other get stronger as the whole expedition went on, and believe in each other more. I think it was honestly exactly what I was looking for when getting into mountaineering, that, you know, brotherhood of the rope. Even though it's a cliche saying, I really loved that. That's what truly came out to be during this expedition. And I hope that everyone else and, you know, us three in the future will go on other trips and be able to come together like that, because that's really beautiful when it all works out like that. And it wouldn't even matter if we summited on the second time. I think the outcome of this expedition would be a greater success, because we had not a single fight during this whole expedition. A month and a half, we had not a single disagreement that anyone came out upset about. what I loved about this team in particular is that from the beginning, we set expectations about expressing our feelings to each other. And if something bothers one of us, we encourage everyone to speak up so that there's nothing missed in the process. And I think it helped a lot to make everyone happy. And I think maybe that's more common in younger climbers to be more open with your feelings, and not as common maybe. Well, I'm about 10 years older than Hayden and Christian. So even though I'm not that much older, it's still, I feel like there is a little bit of a generational gap. When I was growing up, as a kid, I was told to harden up and not express my feelings if something is bothering me. But I feel like in the present, people are a lot better about that and being more open about how you feel, so you don't end up, keeping something that upsets you on the inside.
Yeah, that's a wonderful insight. And I think it reflects a truth. And in the end, you guys held it together, became a stronger team, and then what happened?
Then we sent Dinar.
Yeah, we went back up and gave it a second try, kind of in the same style, but we took a day, one full day, to climb the whole first like snow section up to the col, and then we had left in some like crucial like beaks and some of those like hard slab pitches right off the start, and then we're like, all right, like we all agreed that jugging last time sucked, because last time like every now and then someone would like try to like Jumar behind. We're like, well, that was like pretty time inefficient and it was like just annoying to do, so we're like, let's just all try to free climb, it's more fun and we'll probably be faster anyway. And so we ended up being able to free climb everything up to the summit from there, which was really cool. We were just doing the fix and follow method, which I me and Hayden have done a lot of, and it was pretty cool how well it worked even in this terrain. It was nice to give the leader some breaks, just hang out and put a jacket on and eat food, and then the followers can take their time getting up.
Yeah. And did you essentially go from ABC to the summit in a single day?
That was 2 days.
Yeah. And tell us about the difficulties. This is that kind of part where you describe the experience in numbers. The route was how long, and in the end, what was the summit elevation, and what was the overall grade?
Well, yeah, so our advanced base camp was a little under 16,000 feet, with the summit at 19,840 feet or something around there. And the technical climbing started at around 17 or 17.2. So the first day we went from advanced base camp at a little below 16 and went all the way up to the ridge, which there's a big, kind of the only place on the entire route where you could bivvy. There's a big overhanging cornice that had a spot just big enough for a two-person tent, which the three of us slept in. And so that day was how we did it the first time. And so the second time we got up there before it got dark, but it's a huge day. And the climbing there starts out with some steeper, kind of old, junky glacial ice pitches, getting over Bergschrund. There's a little pillar. And then it goes to kind of a lot of steep snow climbing with rock pinches throughout it. So there's mixed climbing. And then in the last three pitches to the col where we bivvied, it kind of shapes up into mostly just mixed climbing. And so a lot of the climbing in those pitches was, yeah, there's snow, but it's just sugar that's going to crumble. And so you got to clear off every step that you want to try to make up the mountain and climb. You got to clear off all the rock and just figure out how you're going to mix climb around it, or mostly dry tool. So, yeah, then the second day, it was the two pitches that Christian had explored, Vitaly had explored on the first one. They both fired these crux pitches at M7 plus, and then we were into new terrain that we hadn't hit on the first attempt, and the climbing just kept being hard. It kept being really technical mixed climbing with lots of sugary snow, and the rock started degrading towards the summit. So the last three pitches to the summit were, I think, between M5 and M6, every single one of them, and they all were just pretty bad rock quality. So protection was tough. There was not ice to put screws in. The rock was terrible, and it was just delicate, time-consuming stuff. But eventually, Christian popped out on top, and it was just after sunset, and we were stoked.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. Yeah. What did it feel like up there for you guys after going through all this?
Like a dream come true.
Yeah, I had probably about 20 minutes up there by myself while they were following the last pitch. And I mean, it was just dark. You couldn't really see anything, but it was just kind of crazy. I was just like totally alone and like the pitch black on top of a Himalayan summit. I was like, this is wild. Like, wow. I never thought I would be on top of anything here.
And so you get back to base camp. What was it like emerging into the world? Because Christian, I think you and I had a little text exchange. You were mentioning like getting, you're like, wow, we're out of base camp. We're out of the hills. We're in the world. And I think the question I posed was, well, the big question is, which one is reality? Can you reflect on this at all, any of you? Or
yeah, I thought that question was hilarious because, I mean, you're right. You're in this wild place and you're so far removed from what we traditionally call reality. But it's very real when you're there. Like, your life becomes very simple, which is kind of the beauty of it. I think one of the reasons that, you know, we all aspire to do some of this style of climbing every now and then. Yeah, because it is very real. Like, there was a few moments on our climb for me where, like, how simple life was like so apparent. One of which was when I was just holding a jet boil for like 3 hours, boiling water, when we were just sitting on like a little chopped out ledge, and like, that's the only thing I could do. I literally couldn't do anything if I wanted to because we needed to drink water and the jet boil needed to not tip over. And I had this moment in my head. I recognized, oh yeah, this is my life's purpose. Like, and that's it. There's literally nothing else I can do right now. And you know, that world is as equally real as the world that we're living in now, which is kind of the fun disparity of doing this style of climbing, I think.
Yeah. Hayden, did you have any, realizations upon emergence into this quote unquote real world?
Yeah, I feel like coming back, it's overwhelming, but it's also something that you've deprived yourself by choice of so many of the comforts of the world. And so I just remember coming off the summit, we got to advance base camp, we essentially needed to leave base camp the next day to hike out. So we needed to pull everything that day, and suddenly you're over it. I think we had food at advanced base camp, but it was like ramen noodles. And all three of us were, nope, we're not eating that. I'd rather not eat than do that. And so the progress of coming back is dramatic, because until the moment that we'd hit the summit and realized the dream, the simple life is all you want. It's what you live and breathe up there. It's what you spend every moment thinking in a calculated way. Is this helping me get up there? Is this helping the team succeed? Then yes, I'm going to do it. And then once we had summited and we'd made it back to advanced base camp, it was like, okay, now I can start focusing on all the other things going on in my life. And so as we made it then down to base camp and then started trekking out and got phone service, it's you start regaining all these comforts of life, and you can actually really enjoy them because, I don't know, I guess you've scratched the itch. You've had a successful climb. You've made deep, meaningful friendships with people. You've had the experience you came there for. And so now it feels fitting that you can re-welcome all the comforts of the world back into your life.
And so, Vitaly, you've been on a couple of these expeditions. How is this different in your reemergence into the world?
I didn't feel too different about reemergence into the world. In general, I've been doing climbing for so many years and doing big trips into the mountains. Even in the Sierra, you know, going in for a week into the mountains at a time, quite often. So I'm kind of used to that. But I, like everyone else, I love this simple living, and I love to catch up on rest on expeditions because I almost feel like after training for it for a while, it's nice to finally be at a place where you can just rest and take it one step at a time with very limited purpose to every day of your existence.
Yeah. Well, this just sounds like a fantastic journey for the three of you, and congratulations. Is there anything you'd like to add to tell our audience about?
I would like to know, for Hayden and Vitaly, if there were any just small hilarious moments that you guys remember, because I have a couple in my head and I just want to see what y'all's are.
How hilarious.
Just like, I don't know, like the one that comes to my mind is whenever we ran out of water, or whenever the stove broke and we ran out of, we realized we couldn't make coffee. The first thing that you did, Vitaly, was you opened three packs of Trader Joe's instant coffee and just poured them in your mouth dry, which I thought was hilarious.
Do you remember when I offered to drink my pee in order for us to go to the summit?
Yeah, that would have been taking one for the team. That would have been good.
There were a lot of funny moments during this expedition. I think every night hanging out with Anant was hilarious.
Yeah, there's some good. We played Monopoly Deal. It was the one game we brought up, and Anant, the LO, taught our cooks, who were Stenzin and Shring. We had a language barrier, so Anand was the translator. He taught a Monopoly Deal during our first attempt. And so then when we were back at base camp, we would get into these heated games of Monopoly Deal, where even though we didn't share common language with Stenzin and Shring, we could all, through this game, really connect and get into a playful mode of kind of shit talking and, trying to one up and win the game. And those are really memorable highs for me.
To me personally, what comes to mind is when Hayden went down to base camp to bring up more food, me and Christian were left up in our advanced base camp, and we spent a couple nights just talking and hanging out together, and we talked through some really important things that actually later on helped me reconnect and have a very meaningful conversation with my mom. And I think that was probably one of the more important parts for me about this expedition, is that it was almost like talking to a therapist. That's the kind of conversation I think Christian and I had up there that were, I think, helpful to both of us in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think we're all on the same page as far as we like each other as climb partners, because we're all very open and willing to be vulnerable with how we feel and making hard decisions. And I mean, that's why I love climbing with you guys, because I know it's going to be a hilarious time, and I know that we can make the right call when it comes to that. So I think in that regard, we all succeeded for sure.
Well, geez. Thanks a lot to the three of you, and once again, congratulations on this wonderful first ascent in the Himalayas. And that's it.
Thank you, Pete.
Thanks guys.
Thanks for inspiring us to make the trip happen. You were really the the starting point on this one. So thanks a lot.
And thanks to American Alpine Club and the Cutting Edge Grant for helping us out as well. I feel like everyone should join the Alpine Club and be a part of it, because it's helping everyone, not just the sponsored climbers. They helped people like us who are just, you know, your typical 9-to-5ers. So thank you.
Thanks to Pete, Christian, Hayden, and Vitaly for sharing their story. Since these climbers frequently mention their logistics agency in India and their liaison officer, and since they obviously had a good experience, I wanted to say that the agency was Ind Masif, and the local contact was Kapil Malhotra. The LO was Anant Singh. This is the final episode of the 2023 season for The Cutting Edge, which has been made possible by presenting sponsor Hilleberg the Tentmaker, along with support from Blue Ice and Bivouac Coffee. I also want to thank Sierra McGivney for her editing help, along with this year's interviewers, Pete Takeda, Michael Levy, and Chris Kalman. For the next few months, we'll be focused on editing and designing the 2024 American Alpine Journal. Once that's done, this podcast will return with more cutting-edge stories from the AHA. Until then, this is Dougal McDonald, wishing you safe and happy climbs in the new year.